put you down a little while. Well, you done made me mess up my happy home.
Willie Dixon, he was born on this day. The great Willie Dixon. So we hear a piece of his music, I Can't Quit You Baby. We'll be talking about his music during the course of the next couple hours during our breaks. We are joined now by Michelle Goldberg, who is senior contributing editor.
Happen any time you're listening to.
We're now joined by Michelle Goldberg, who is senior contributing writer to The Nation magazine, author of Means of Production, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, and Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And we're joined by Roger Pilon, who is the B. Kenneth Simon Chair of Constitutional Studies and Director of the Center for Constitutional Studies for the Cato Institute. And welcome both of you. Good to have you with us here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888, as we examine the Hobby Lobby decision. Michelle Goldberg, I was reading your pieces last night on this decision. Many people were waiting to see what would happen. First of all, let's describe this decision and what you think the broad reach of this might or might not be.
Right. Well, the decision was, you know, from my point of view, a terrible thing for American women, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been because it basically said the broad contraceptive mandate in the Affordable Care Act remains in place, but closely held corporations like Hobby Lobby, and let's be clear, most American corporations are closely held, right? These are corporations that are where most of the stock is held by five or more people. They're mostly family businesses, but not all of them are family businesses. They can exempt themselves from the contraceptive mandate by claiming religious exemptions. And, I mean, it's notable for a few things. It's notable in that it means that, you know, thousands, and I don't think we quite know yet how many women are going to lose this benefit and basically pay more for their medications than men in the same jobs and at the same companies. But the other thing that's striking, well, there's a couple things that are striking about it. One of the other things that's striking about it is that, you know, we've seen kind of corporate personhood taken to, you know, the metaphorical idea of corporate personhood taken to greater and greater extremes under the Supreme Court. This is the kind of latest step forward in that idea, in that now corporations have religious rights and the right to exercise religion, even when that right, you know, conflicts with the rights of their employees.
So, Roger Pilon, your thoughts on this? This is, you know, when you look at the case history involved in this, and you go back to the 63 decisions of Sherbert v. Verner, and it seems to be turning things upside down. What is the significance of this to you?
Well, the significance is that religious liberty has been upheld by this decision, consistent with the statute. Goldberg says that this is a terrible decision for American women. That would be difficult to explain to the hundreds of young women who were standing outside the Supreme Court yesterday cheering this decision. Goldberg is speaking only for some American women.
As are the women standing outside the court.
Yes, that's right. Now, most corporations, she said, are closely held, and that may be true, but that doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily really raise religious objections to that. That's probably, as Justice Alito said, only a few will. Her complaint seems to be against RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was the statute under which this decision was made. And that was passed overwhelmingly. In fact, there were only three in the Senate who voted against it. So that's Democrats and Republicans alike who supported that law. She says we don't know how many women will lose contraceptives under this. It's likely to be none. Why? Because there is already an accommodation that HHS has provided for nonprofit religious corporations, and all they need to do, as Justice Alito said, is extend that accommodation to profit corporations, and we come to the same result.
All right, so Michelle, let me ask you this kind of gap between the notion for some people of religious liberty and people running businesses and how the two have intersected over the years around these issues. And I'm thinking about the earlier decision of 63 of Sherbert versus Verner.
Well, I want to take issue with his idea that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 kind of necessarily mandates this decision, right? The Religious Freedom Restoration Act says government may not substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion. And so, again, I think that what we're seeing here is an expansion of the idea of corporate personhood. And the very fact that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed so overwhelmingly is evidence of the fact that Congress did not intend to give corporations the same kind of religious liberty as individuals. Otherwise, that would have been an incredibly controversial idea that would not have garnered overwhelming Democratic support. You know, and so this is obviously not a kind of obvious extrapolation from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. If it was, you wouldn't have had, you know, kind of scathing dissents from four members of the court, including, I note, all three women on the court.
Well, Ms. Goldberg is framing this as a case of the corporation having religious rights. Nobody argues that on my side of this issue. What we argue instead is that the corporation is nothing more than a fictitious person, as has been understood in law for several centuries now. It is a form in which individuals conduct business. And just as you can pierce the corporate veil, as the legal idiom has it, to hold corporate officers and actors liable, so too you can do so to uphold not only their obligations but their rights. And so this is nothing more than the individuals conducting business through the corporate form consistent with their religious principles. So it's the people in the corporation whose rights are being protected by this. Nobody is arguing that the corporation
is practicing religion. Well, it's certain people in the corporation. It's certainly
religion.
Not the employees of the corporation who are now kind of subject, whose compensation is now subject to the dictates to the religious beliefs of their bosses or of the owners of the corporations that they're working for.
Nobody forces these people to work at that corporation. Indeed, you seem to suggest that the employer has an obligation, other than through positive law, to provide health care for its insurers. That is not the case, much less
health insurance.
You see,
this is an amazing argument to say that, like,
kind.
Women are...
Just a minute.
Under this rule, women's compensation is less than their male
colleagues.
Excuse me, just
while you're interrupting.
You both interrupted one another, so that it's an equal and fair interruption here. Give a final thought what you're saying, Roger. I want to go back to what Michelle was trying to say. Go ahead.
Are you talking to me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The point is that the corporation is nothing more, just like a partnership or some other form of business association, it's the institution through which people conduct their business. And all these people are asking is to conduct their business consistent with their religious principles.
But, okay, go ahead, Michelle.
Well, the thing that I think was amazing was when he just said nobody's forcing people to work at this corporation, because, you know, this is a response that you might hear to any sort of discriminatory behavior on the part of a corporation. And I think we should be really clear that when women's prescription medicines, the most commonly prescribed prescription medicines for women are not covered by their insurance, while the vast majority of prescription medicines for men are covered, you have women's compensation being worth less than their male colleagues. And to say that that discrimination is okay because nobody's forcing them to work there, that is kind of, you know, we have a whole body of civil rights law that says that just because people are not being forced to work at a company, that doesn't give the company carte blanche to discriminate, just as it doesn't give them kind of carte blanche to pay below the minimum wage or impose other sorts of adverse working conditions.
Well, if you want to recast
again,
I
think when you resort to that argument, well, nobody forces you to work there, then in a way you're kind of acknowledging that this is a set of policies that's likely to really hurt a lot of employees.
So the question I have here is, and I think one of the leading questions here, and I think you can see it by the divided court that we have in America right now, it's like the divided American public opinion, is that is that are we saying here now that corporations are allowed to make decisions based on the moral principles and religious principles of the people who own them, despite what the majority of people who work for them might feel when it comes to either their benefits, like the reproductive rights or interracial marriage or whatever that might be? There are some churches who do oppose interracial marriage. Well, does that mean that they wouldn't hire somebody because they married somebody outside of their race? Is that now going to be allowed? I mean, is this a slippery slope to allowing corporations to do whatever it is they damn well please?
Well, there's something interesting in the decision in that Alito, you know, says that this does says that it's kind of very narrowly focused and applies, and this logic applies only for the purposes of this case and only in regards to contraception. So it doesn't necessarily apply to things like vaccinations or blood transfusions, which are also procedures that are opposed by certain religious groups. And on the one hand, this is a good thing in that, you know, it does kind of possibly mitigate some of the slippery slope concerns that a lot of us had with this case. You know, just what you said, that when you kind of grant religious liberty to corporations, where does it end? On the other hand, it also sort of undermines the logic that the religious that what the court is trying to do is simply protect the religious liberty of bosses, and that's a paramount concern. Because if that was a paramount concern, then presumably you would want to protect the religious liberty of employers who, you know, opposed all sorts of other medical procedures on doctrinal grounds. But they don't do that because they know it's ridiculous. They've kind of carved out this very strange, special dispensation for a certain brand of religious believers who have a problem with contraception.
This is interesting that you put it that way, carved out a special thing. This is the problem that you get into, if I may go back to first principles. When you live in a regime in which the presumption is that the government may regulate anything, and now we have to carve out exceptions, that is pretty much what we've gotten to in this country today. It used to be the case that an employer and an employee could come together on whatever terms were mutually agreeable. Now we have an overlay of regulations of all sorts that regulate every aspect of the employment context. And therefore, what we have to do is start carving out exceptions, as this case plainly is, for religious liberty. That's what RFRA was all about.
What about, let me ask this question.
For a religious exception, but no other exception.
We don't have a little bit of time. Let me ask this question. What does that mean, though, Michelle, for the religious liberty and the liberties of the employees themselves?
Well, as the other speaker is saying, you believe that these employer-employee relationships should be kind of entirely free from regulation, then, you know, as he said, they can go work somewhere else. In the real world, where, you know, these are kind of huge power differentials between employers and employees, it basically means that your boss's religious belief, at least when it comes to reproductive health care, overrides your own, you know, because for the vast, I understand that not all American women, you know, not all American women are pro-choice, not all American women certainly are Democrats, there are certainly people who oppose this law, but almost all American women, you know, 98-99% of American women have at some point in their reproductive life used birth control. So for the overwhelming majority of American women, this is not a religious or doctrinal problem, and their right to kind of access medical services with their compensation, that's again, this isn't, you know, something that their employers are giving them out of the goodness of their heart. This is part of their compensation. That is being reduced, you know, whatever their own personal religious beliefs, because of the religious beliefs of the people who own their companies.
So, well, we have a quick email from Sheldon Laskin. Sheldon, who suggests that that more than anything, that the Supreme Court's decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby illustrates the need for a single payer healthcare system that does not involve employers. A system like this would relieve them of any burden and allow everyone to have equal health insurance in this country, without being worried about anybody's religious views.
Well, that would be one solution, but the solution would be worse than the situation that we have now. If I may go back to a point that it seems to me Michelle has not picked up on, it is this. the claim by Justice Goldberg, who so distorted Justice Alito.
Justice Ginsburg.
I mean, who so distorted Justice Alito's opinion that women will be without contraceptive protection.
But they will
Nothing
be.
Could be.
They will be.
Because Mark, are you a moderator or are you a participant?
I'm both. Because I am a moderator. I have all sides in this, but I have to say that I've never made any bones about the fact that I have been for women's reproductive choice my entire life and been part of the abortion underground in the 1960s with my mother. So I make no bones about that. That's who I am. So, yes, I'm a bit of both, but that's why I raised that issue, to be very clear.
Now, do you want to listen?
I've always been listening. Go ahead.
All right. The point I made was that Justice Ginsburg argued that women would be without contraceptive protection. Nothing could be further from the truth. This opinion was very clear that, first of all, no one is denying it to them. Women could buy it on their own. Moreover, there are provisions already that HHS has made to provide coverage free for non-profit corporations. All they need to do is extend those over to the for-profit corporations that are closely held, who object for religious reasons, and this problem is solved. It's no more complicated than that. Women will not be without contraceptive protection.
Michelle?
Well, two things. I mean, first of all, this HHS accommodation he's talking about has, of course, been fiercely fought by conservatives and will continue to be fiercely fought by conservatives. But more than that, you keep hearing this, well, women can go buy it themselves. Nobody is denying it to them. And, you know, that's true. And that's especially true for people who have money and can kind of lay out, you know, $500 or $1,000 for an IUD if that's what their doctor recommends, or, you know, $60 a month for the birth control pill. That's not a hardship for some people. I think it might be a hardship for somebody who's working, you know, on the floor at Hobby Lobby. But more than that, it's also a question of equality. Certainly, you can go and buy it on your own, but your insurance is part of your compensation package. And so when your insurance covers all or 90% or of a male employee's medications, but doesn't cover the most frequently prescribed medications for female employees, their compensation is essentially less. And so, yes, they can go and take their own money and buy insurance, but let's be clear, it means that they are being paid less than their male colleagues.
This is not coverage for male contraceptives if you want to talk about equality. This is
no, we're talking about male medications.
Contraceptives I'm talking about.
No, I'm talking about the most frequently prescribed medications, full stop, for women and for men. Most women, you know, again, this idea that this is some kind of, that this is not a kind of a serious medical need for women, contraception.
Who said that?
I think that if you did say that, then you couldn't possibly be so cavalier about the idea that
well, sure,
it would
did
not
say
be
that,
covered.
But I didn't say it. Let's also note another aspect of this. This is not a statute, that is to say, the requirement to provide 21 forms of contraceptive that Congress passed. This is merely a rule that HHS on its own enacted, which raises fundamental questions about the Obama administration's ruling on its own in vast areas. It just got slapped down on the recess appointments thing, and here today or yesterday it got slapped down again on this regulation.
Michelle, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to get Michelle to have a word before we have to go out. Michelle?
I mean, I don't know. To me, that seems to be changing the subject. You know, you kind of this is how legislation works. You know, Congress passes law and the administration figures out how to implement it. And
this isn't implementation. This is rewriting.
Well, I think maybe that does go to the heart of it. We have to end here. Maybe that does go to the heart of it, because I think all of this is part of the battle between what America is and what America is becoming. And whether it's the conservative vision and corporate vision, or whether it's the other vision of America.
That's a false characterization,
well,
Mark.
You raised it first, Roger. You just raised it.
Listen, we're talking about the modern imperial executive state.
That George Bush did a much better job at than President Barack Obama, though neither one did a very good job at it. I want to thank you both for being with us. Roger Pilon, who is the Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies and Director of the Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Michelle Goldberg, Senior Contributing Writer for The Nation and author of The Means of Production, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, and Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. I'll be back on the air soon to talk about those books. Thank you so much both for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
We're going out with Hoochie Coochie Man, the birthday of the great Willie Dixon. Stay with us.
Gonna make these pretty women jump and shout, and the world wanna know.